Now and again my dreams of glory would be broken by the vision of Selim, whom I, in intent if not in act, had murdered, and like a dim wraith, no more material than are the clouds that float across the sky, the face and form of my victim would hover near, distorted and disfigured by the agonies of his violent death, even as I had seen the wraith of Jalal ad-Din on the day when I had visited his deserted house, and seen my vision of Zuleika and Selim in the magic mirror. The forms of both these haunting shapes bore the impress of the same violent death, and I had little doubt were due to the same unseen agency. Not often, however, did these ghosts of my past obtrude themselves upon me, and I was so much absorbed in the active life of material existence that I had but little time to think of my occult studies. Tonight, however, the spirit world seemed strangely near to me once more. The gates so long closed were again ajar. My senses were so abnormally acute that the distant sounds in the palace fell with startling distinctness upon my ears, and the far-off hooting of an owl sounded like the warning note of a feathered sentinel. Very gradually and imperceptibly, I sank into a state of slumber, and then the unconsciousness of sleep gave place unto a vision. Methti walked within a fair garden, wherein bloomed the fairest flowers of earth, and away beyond the garden I could behold the blue misty outlines of a lofty range of hills. A clear stream flowed at my feet, and soft trees waved their green branches above my head. Then, even as I gazed upon this fair scene, dark storm clouds rose and swept over the sunlit garden, enveloping all in their darkness. The clear crystal stream changed into a rushing, roaring muddy river, whose dark waters rose and rose till they had engulfed me, and I was swept from the fair garden and borne downwards on the rushing, roaring stream's thick, muddy water. I was swept on and on. It seemed to me I travelled on that dark flood for an immense time, yet it could only have been a few moments of earthly time. At last I found myself being borne past some mighty rocks, which reared their dark heads above the turbulent stream, and in my fear and anguish I grasped hold of one great rock as I was swept past. With the grasp of despair I held on to it, although the dark waters well nigh swept me away, and at last a tiny star appeared from the blackness above me, and as the star flickered o'er my head, a voice said, "Hold on and raise thyself, for your own hand must raise you up, even as your own hand had caused your fall." With frantic haste I struggled to arise and to free myself from the clinging weeds, the long rope-like grass and reeds, which grew in that sullen stream and held me like ropes of iron. And at last I seemed to rise and shake myself free, till one limb after another was released, and I stood upon the hard, sharp surface of the rock in safety. Then did I behold a figure beside me wrapped in a mantle of silver grey that sparkled as with many glittering drops of dew, which like tiny stars of light bespangled the spirit's robes. As I looked, the veil, which had hid the face was drawn aside, and I beheld the features of my long-lost friend, the dear companion of my boyhood, Abubatha. His face shone with a radiance like the halo around a saint. His smile was sad and tender, and his voice low and musical as a silver bell, as he spoke these words to me, "Oh, Ahensimen, my beloved friend. Dear youth whom I loved as a son, I pray you think of holier things than the vain pleasures of the earth. Turn to nobler thoughts than the thought of selfish ambition. Nourish not this longing for revenge, for you are more than avenged already, did you but know it, and the sordid thirst to inflict suffering upon those who wrong you is as these dark weeds, which imprisoned your limbs, and evil thoughts are like yon rushing stream that bears men to destruction. None can enslave you but thyself. None can have dominion over your soul unless you thyself give them the power. Assert that sovereignty over thyself, which is the divine prerogative of all mankind, and yield not thyself a subject to any, be it to the dark angels or to your own evil passions. Awake, my son. Arouse thyself, for enemies draw near you. Yet is the enemy you shouldst dread most of all your own undisciplined passionate heart." I tried to rush forward and touch the figure as he ceased to speak, but he faded and was gone ere I could move, and I awoke with a shock to find myself standing with outstretched arms in the middle of my room. Chapter 33, The Secret Passage. When I succeeded to the throne of Persia, I had caused to be closed up the wing of the palace at Barsaik-ud-Din, which my mother and Selim had alike met their deaths, and in order that none might use again the ill-omened secret passage, I caused the door opening into the late king's rooms to be built up. The other door I left untouched, since no one was likely to use it, as the fatal chamber into which it opened, being thought to be haunted, was avoided by all. On this night, however, this deserted wing of the palace was no longer in solitary darkness. Access to it from outside had been obtained through a private entrance known only to Artemisia, and now Ahmed, Artemisia, Zuleika and a slave in attendance upon Ahmed, glided softly and swiftly through the silent and neglected rooms. Ahmed had lost no time in following out the idea suggested by Zuleika. He had hunted up my history with the robber tribe. He had seen Dilfarib and the artful Haji, whom he found ready to assist him in his plans. The same night Ahmed had arranged that emissaries of his own should be scattered through all the principal towns in Persia, to circulate simultaneously a garbled and strange account of my history and doings, showing how I was the vilest of men. This, and much more, did Ahmed cause to be circulated concerning me, but so artful was he that he did not circulate these tales until he had so carefully laid his plans to compass my death that there was little fear that I would ever have the chance of explaining my actions or contradicting these wild stories, so near the truth yet so false in reality. Ahmed was accompanied by a slave, a strange deaf and dumb creature, with whom he could communicate by signs so perfectly that it was seldom the deaf mute failed to carry out all Ahmed's instructions correctly, while his affliction made it impossible for him to betray easily his master's secrets. Tonight Ahmed had entered the palace by this secret way, in order that he and the slave might open from the inside one of the smaller gates to admit a large body of his soldiers, who, fully armed and prepared for a fierce resistance, awaited his summons. In the East, treachery of every kind is the great evil rulers and ruled alike have most to fear, and treachery and bribery had both been at work to render certain soldiers of my own guard ready to make but a mere feint of resistance when this small gate should be attacked. A larger body of Ahmed's troops were to attack the principal entrance the moment that a given signal should announce to them that their comrades had gained an entrance to the palace, and it was calculated that when thus surprised and assailed from within and without, my own guards would have but a poor chance of successful resistance, while I myself would be assassinated ere I had well realized my danger. As Ahmed and his dumb slave hurried onward, followed by the queen and Zuleika, this conversation took place in dumb show. Ahmed, who carried a tiny lamp to see the way, making signs to his peculiar confidant, which would not be understood by the others, "Dost you see the queen, slave? Mark well that tonight you shall give her a potion so strong that she shall wake no more from her sleep. To one so crazed as she, methinks it were a kindness to help her to find that death, which would seem to have forgotten her." Then to himself Ahmed added, "I would not have a hellcat like Artemisia about my court for all the wealth and glory of Persia. I would never know when she might take a fancy to stick her claws into me." In order to reach the wing of the palace where I dwelt, it was necessary to pass through the rooms, which Selim had assigned to me when I was in his service, and as they approached the one in which Zuleika had slept, and Selim died, she drew back and hesitated to enter it. A shudder of fear passed over her, for to her eyes it appeared for a moment as though the contorted body of the murdered man yet lay upon the floor, a dread thing of fear she could not pass. Moreover, she had begun to repent of her intention to be present to see me die. She had thought it would be sweet to her to be thus avenged upon me for my scorn of her. But now that the critical moment was so near, she drew back, and felt that she could not go on. She could not look upon death again. The memory of Selim as he lay dead at her feet was too horrible to her. She stopped, as Ahmed and his dumb slave passed out of the upper doorway, leaving her alone with Artemisia in that fatal room. Ahmed was too absorbed in his own purpose, and the palace was too dark, for him to notice whether the two women were following him closely or not, and he passed on without missing them. Zuleika's impulse was to turn and fly by the way they had entered, but ere she could do so, Artemisia laid her hand upon Zuleika's arm, and said in a low tone of great melancholy, yet with more sanity than she had shown of late, "Doth it fill you with sorrow, even as it does me, to enter this palace again, to picture to thyself the happy hours as well as those of sadness, which we have known within its walls. I could almost say the ghost of my dead son stood near us now, and that I had but to stretch out my hands to touch him. Doth it seem the same to you?" Zuleika shuddered and drew back from the queen, as she glanced around apprehensively. "Oh no! No! There is surely no one here but you and me. It is too horrible to think that the dead might come to us. Let us away from this dreadful room. I cannot go on. I cannot see Ahrensamund die. I cannot think of death, and a violent death, again." At the mention of my name, Artemisia's mood changed to one of passionate frenzy, and in a fierce eager whisper she hissed into Zuleika's ear, while she grasped her arm like a vice, "You dost fear to see Ahrensamund die, you paltry, weak-minded fool? You dost shudder at the thought of death within these walls wherein died my son? I tell you the whole atmosphere is full of death. It taints the air we breathe, as though this palace were a charnel house. The ghosts of those who died within this room are with us now, and they mock and point at us with their skeleton fingers, and gibe at us with their dumb lips. You art in the presence of death now. Its black mantle falls like a shadow around you, as though it would enwrap you in its sable folds, and yet you sayest you dost not want to see Ahrensamund die? O powers of hell! And you! You art afraid!" she cried, her madness growing into a fit of frenzy, then changing to a chuckle of laughter, she suddenly released Zuleika's arm. "You art afraid, afraid. If so, go, go. See what a fine means of escape there is for you. Far better than returning alone through yon dark rooms, wherein of a surety you wilt die of fright ere you dost reach the gates. See, my sweet Zuleika, my timid, gentle fawn, enter you at this small door, and it will take you straight to a room, which opens into the great hall, beside the great doors of the palace, which are thronged even now by our followers who will soon be pouring into the hall, for the dumb slave will have opened by now the door and let them in. Come and enter in, that you may be safe, for I must hurry on that I miss the fine sport for, which I have waited now so long." The queen held open the little door into the secret passage as she spoke, and Zuleika, frightened and anxious to escape from the mad woman beside her, hastily entered the passage, counting that she would be able to get out at the other door, for she did not know I had walled it up. But Artemisia knew it. With a wild shriek of insane laughter, which rang through the deserted rooms and reached even to where I sat, Artemisia shut the door upon Zuleika and fastened it upon the outside, dragging some heavy furniture before it to make it the more secure to her frenzied mind. "Oh sweet, sweet, sweet is this hour to me," she cried through the closed doorway. "Rich, rich shall be your reward, fair Zuleika. Long may you enjoy the harvest of all your wiles and all your petty schemes. You wilt have ample time to enjoy the memory of the past, for you shall lie and rot within these walls, and all your fair beauty with which you did beguile my son unto his death shall turn to loathsome decay ere one shall come to succor you. Die, die. Like a rat in a trap, a toad in a hole, and in your death agonies remember that it is thus that Artemisia had rewarded you." Then, like a maniac, laughing and muttering to herself, Artemisia rushed after the others, while the unfortunate Zuleika, realizing the horrors of her position, uttered shriek after shriek of alarm and agony, sounds which, alas, brought none to her aid, for did they not come from the haunted part of the palace, and only inspired with superstitious terror those who heard them? None thought they came from a human being in mortal extremity, for none knew that aught in human form would venture into those fatal rooms, and soon the sound of Zuleika's shrieks were drowned in a yet greater tumult. Chapter 34, The Curtain of Death. I was still musing upon my vision, and wondering to what danger Abubatha's warning pointed, when on the stillness of a night there broke first the muffled sound of Artemisia's wild laugh and then Zuleika's frenzied shriek, and as I grasped my scimitar and hurried to the door to see from whence these sounds came, I found myself face to face with the forms of Ahmed and his dumb slave. While the room behind him became quickly filled with the stealthily creeping figures of a number of men, I tried to defend myself, and for a few moments my skill as a swordsman enabled me to keep my assailants at bay, but what can one man do against 20, And though my shouts brought my guards in a few moments around me, and roused the whole palace, the soldiers of Ahmed had found entrance in a half a dozen places. My guards fought well, but they were confused and without any settled plan of defense. While Ahmed's men were carrying out a carefully arranged scheme, desperate was the resistance we made. My soldiers fell beside me fighting to the last, while I myself, though wounded by many a spear thrust, contrived to fight my way into the larger room where the battle was thickest, and strove to rally my guards. But there I succumbed, overwhelmed by numbers and mortally wounded. For a brief moment I lost consciousness, then I revived to find myself almost alone, while the tide of battle had swept past me towards the great hall. As I opened my eyes I saw that the grey dawn of day was breaking, and the dim light from the casement fell across the floor where I lay. I could not raise myself, I could not move. My life blood was flowing from my many wounds and forming a deep red pool upon the floor, and as I raised my fast glazing eyes from it, I saw a woman's figure stoop over the crimson pool, and dip her hands in the warm blood as though she were washing them, while to herself she kept muttering and laughing in soft, exultant tones of pleasure. With a start I recognized Artemisia, and grasping my dagger I made a frantic effort to raise myself and stab her where she knelt. But my feeble hand fell powerless by my side, my dying grasp relaxed, and I sank back upon the ground in the last agony of the great change, which men call death. And as my eyes closed I saw Artemisia bend forward over me, with the cruel, vindictive smile of gratified malice, even as I had seen her do in my vision so long ago. And the last thing mine earthly sight beheld was the look of mingled hatred and fiendish triumph in the eyes of Queen Artemisia. The legacy I bore with me to the spirit world was the legacy of our fierce hate. Thus felt the curtain of death upon the first act of that drama which had been begun in our earthly lives, and which was yet to be acted out upon the wider, grander stage of the spirit world. For as we had sown the wind, so verily was each one of us to reap the whirlwind. End of Part I, The Strange Story of Ahrin Zimman, Part II, The Reaping of the Harvest _, Chapter 1, The Awakening in the Abyss of Inferno. From a death sleep of years, my soul at last awoke to a renewal of its conscious individuality. For as a fruit that is plucked untimely from the tree must be ripened by artificial means ere the living seeds within can attain the degree of development necessary to their germination, so the soul, which is hurried from the earthly stage of life before the spiritual body is sufficiently developed to serve as the medium for its sustainment, must lie like a germinating seed within the green husk of its astral envelope until the gradual ripening of the truly spiritual germ, and the consequent decay of a mere astral husk or shell, shall, in accordance with the law of all nature, release the soul seed, which has lain sheltered within the protecting envelope till it was ripe for the life of the spirit world. The souls of all who die before they have lived the full span allotted to man are not necessarily cut off from the tree of life in an unripened state. Many who thus seem to die too soon have already reached the measure of the experience earth was destined to give them. They have gathered their ripened sheaves, and for them the dagger of the assassin, the sword of the enemy, the chill hand of pestilence, or the seemingly untoward accident, was but the key that unlocked for them the gloomy portals of that gate whose guardian angel men call death. It was but to a dream consciousness in the astral world that my soul at first awoke, a nightmare compared to the clear and serene consciousness of the spirit that has attained to its true life in the spirit spheres, but yet a terrible reality to the self that was emerging from its deep sleep. Have you never, when your soul has been weighed down by some oppression, passed through horrible scenes and agonies of experience that were as realities at the time, yet emerged at last into the serene waking into the fresh dawn light of another day? But what if you could not wake, and your painful oppression continued its sense of reality for years and years? In my case, my earthly life was an unfinished story, a half-written page, whose blurred message and half-learned lessons required that my soul should hover near the earth to learn completely. In the darkness of the astral plane, upon the earth yet not of the earth, lay my soul in its death trance, for several years absorbing unconsciously the atmosphere of earthly magnetism which was needful to sustain its life, and ripen that spiritual envelope through, which I was again to manifest my individuality. Such was the penalty I paid for the great debasement and passions from which I had not freed my soul when it was hurried from its earthly tenement, the debasement of my licentiousness when living with Jalal ad-Din, and the passions of earthly pride and murderous revenge that dominated my soul through its brief career, and still dominated it against Selim, Zuleika and Artemisia. While my soul still burned with the fire of this wild passion, it remained in the domains of my dark angel in the regions of Inferno, the astral spheres beneath the earth plane. But why dwell at length over the horrible episodes that now seemed part of my life? Let it suffice to show that these experiences are all bound by a definite law of correspondence, and to warn my fellow beings against the consequences of similar acts of earth life. As you sowest, so shall you reap. In a mighty cavern of the astral plane, my soul awoke at last, and as one who arouses himself from a troubled sleep, I turned and gazed upon my surroundings. I thought at first that I had dreamed a troubled dream in which I had been slain, so real and solid to my sight and touch were the grim walls of rock on either side. Then memory awoke, and I remembered that it was in the palace of Barsaghad that I had died. I looked around me and saw that vague, shadowy shapes were flitting about in the semi-darkness, and a chill fear fell upon my soul, for I felt that I was indeed dead, and this the world of the dead that I beheld, and of which I had become a part. Clearer and clearer to my sight grew the misty forms, sharper and yet sharper were the sounds, which fell upon my ears, at first like faint echoes heard in dreams, then with the fullness of material sound. Veil after veil of gauze-like vapor, which appeared to hang between me and my surroundings, seemed slowly to rise and reveal to my eyes the wonders of the dread astral plane wherein I lay. I was still shuddering at the thoughts suggested to me, still thinking with remorse of the days of my own moral degradation when I had lived with Jalal ad-Din and indulged in practices that I now knew to have borne such awful fruit, when I was aroused from my thoughts by the sudden inrush of a crowd of spirits who came yelling and laughing into the cavern where I lay. These last arrivals were so like mortal men and women that I had no trouble in recognizing them as disembodied human beings like myself. In them there was no lack of intelligence, but it was intelligence which had been used for evil and not for good purposes, and the fierce light of passion, the dull glow of hatred, the sullen bitterness of despair, gleamed from their eyes and traced their marks on every feature. These beings gathered around me with angry cries, coarse taunts, and savage shouts of welcome, hailing me as a comrade and reviling me as being to the full as worthy of damnation as themselves. As I shrank back in horror from their clumsy, ferocious embraces, they began to assail me with cries of anger and savage blows, shrieking out to me to look at myself and see in what respect I differed from them, by what right I dared to hold aloof from such good company. Rousing myself by a mighty effort of my will from the trance-like spell which bound me, I sprang up from the hard rock wherein I lay, and hurling aside the nearest of my assailants, rushed from the dark cave along a narrow passage to a wide plain that lay beyond. As I fled, I heard the wild crew whom El had left begin a violent quarrel among themselves, which for the moment caused me to be forgotten. Chapter 2, In the Inferno, the Valley of the Genii. For a short time I felt myself hurried onward. I could neither see nor guess where I appeared to glide over the ground and float in the air, impelled forward by some unseen force. Then my journey was suddenly arrested, and I found myself standing in a wide misty valley, shut in by dark, lofty hills, which rose on every side, while above my head thick clouds of inky vapor hung like a funeral pall. Dark forms of gigantic stature hovered around me with outstretched wings, their dimly outlined forms being those of men, while their wings were shaped like those of mighty birds. Impalpable as smoke wreaths were they, and yet distinct as figures carved from tinted glass, and as transparent. As these phantom forms floated to and fro around me, they crossed and recrossed each other's paths, mingling their dark bodies like streams of vapor, yet each emerging from the contact in as perfect a form as though they had been made of iron. Some of these beings were of enormous size, and bore the impress of individual intelligence in their faces, while others were diminutive and attenuated in figure, and almost vacant in expression. At first these figures were seen by me as through a curtain of dark mist, but even while I gazed on them I felt the same curious impression of curtain after curtain of gauzy vapor being raised around me, which I had felt on awakening in the cavern, and one by one the features and forms of these hovering shapes became distinct to me. I saw that each figure bore upon its forehead a tiny star, like a spark of light, each of a different color, and the shadowy robes which enveloped each form seemed to glitter like the many-colored scales upon a dragon's body in the dull glow of light from these tiny stars, while the outstretched wings that were in shape like unto the wings of a bird, were as gossamer and transparent as a spider's web. As the mists around me rose and floated like clouds away, I noticed that all around me there was a circle of these strange beings, not so large as were many of the others, yet huge hovering phantoms compared to my own stature. To my surprise I saw that the features of each bore so close a resemblance to my own that they looked like replicas of myself, only the expression was different in each case, and represented each the influence of a different passion, even as each phantom shape differed in size and in the color emitted from its tiny star. One, which bore a pale white light, was small, and seemed at times to melt almost away. Another, whose light was green, was also small, and something whispered to me that these represented, the first, the quality of unselfishness, and the second, the passion of envy. The star of a third was yellow, a fourth's pale blue, a fifth's lilac, a sixth's purple, while the seventh star was a deep crimson red. The genie with the purple star was large and towered above his fellows, and to my thoughts he symbolized the boundless ambition that grasps at royal power. The crimson star upon the brow of the seventh genie glowed like a living coal, and the fierce murderous gleam in the bloodshot eyes, the tiger-like ferocity of his expression, told me at once that here was the embodiment of the passions of hatred and revenge and murder. Equal in size unto the genie of ambition, this being was even more instinct with vitality and power. Near to this seventh spirit there hovered a grey and almost shapeless form, with shrouded head and veiled face, that like an attendant shadow dogged the footsteps of the genie of revenge and followed every movement that it made. This grey shape, vague as yet and featureless, almost formless and half-created, I knew to be remorse, whose shadow ever haunts revenge, but whose whisperings are ever powerless to stay his hand. And as I gazed upon the wavering, circling figures of these embodiments of man's passions, a voice again breathed to my soul the interpretation. Behold now these, the attendant genii of your life, who symbolize each a passion of your soul. Born into life when you wast born, fed and sustained by the life of your passions, destined to grow or to fade, to endure or to perish, according to the strength of the vitality and power with which you hast supplied them. Look upon them well, and ask thyself whether they shall be your servants or whether you shall yield thyself unto them as a slave, whether you shall rule them or they shall rule you. Turn your eyes from the contemplation of your own passions and see the structures which have been reared by the passions and desires of other men. For, behold, you art in the phantom valley of the genii of men's souls, and around you are the mighty works which the ambitions, the greed, the jealousy and the anger, the envy and the hatred, the despair and the hope, the selfishness and the unselfishness of myriads of men have created, to endure as monuments of their past lives long after they who created them shall have passed on to other spheres. The true genii whom men call to their aid are but these embodiments of the passions of mankind, the power they wield is but the resistless force of the great ocean of thought waves, which ebb and flow to and from the earth continually, and bear man to sorrow or to joy, to good or evil deeds according as he chooses to commit himself to one or the other of the mighty currents of passion that sweep around the soul. These genii live in these waves of passionate thought as fish swim in the sea. Were they transported to where the fiercer passions no longer sway the soul, they must perish and dissolve like vapor in the sun. Yet here upon the great earth plane they have a distinct existence, and they act and react upon man, suggesting thoughts to him, even as a higher intelligence, be it good or evil, shall direct them. Soulless and perishable, no more material than the thoughts men breathe, they yet possess a mighty power over those who yield themselves unto their passions. Hast you considered how great, How enduring is the power of a single thought sent forth to influence the lives of all to whose minds it is repeated? If so, canst you wonder that the thoughts, the passions, the desires of man, should thus become endowed with an almost independent life, and become in this etherealized atmosphere, almost material beings?